My man, that is fascinating, and I am totally packing. But I just wanted to point out that Paris is closer to Le Havre, assuming that is where you're trying to get.
From Tristan Lyons, 1707.
Yeah, I have Google Maps too. Marginally harder for the bad guys to track you're going into France if you're arriving from a nearby country via ferry, versus arriving in a commercial airliner from Boston.
From Mortimer Shore, 1744.
Tristan, you around? I can't find you anywhere in the house.
From Rebecca East Oda, 1819.
Tristan and Felix are incommunicado. I am giving them a lift to a helicopter charter service at Logan Airport. They have a lot of cash and a lot of equipment.
Entries from Personal Journal of Karpathy Erzsébet.
On the train home to Budapest, 14 July, 1851.
Dear Diary, Mother has been working upon me, or rather trying to, with her ever-weakening abilities, for I can feel her inside my very skull at times over the past few days, trying to convince me to put the spell upon myself willingly. I will not. I considered it, but I know I lack the fortitude to survive the endless decades to come. Budapest, 23 July, 1851. Dear Diary, I have resigned myself to learning a skill, to earn a proper living when magic is no more. With each passing day I feel a diminishing of power and clarity of mind, an almost physical heaviness. I push through it. I have decided I might learn to be a seamstress, for at least then I shall spend my life around beautiful gowns, which I am fond of, even if I soon lack the means to own them. Budapest, 26 July, 1851. Dear Diary, as the days go by, Mother keeps to her chambers, and Father, when I see him, mostly scowls at me. The day after tomorrow is when this horrible eclipse will happen, and then it will all be over.
Mission Log of Tristan Lyons. Written in ballpoint pen on pocket notebook. Day 1960, 10 December, Year 5.
General Intro. I have no idea whether the finder of this notebook is going to consider me a hero, a traitor, or a nobody, but I want to go on record stating I firmly believe my actions are A, important, and B, based on a good faith reading of my service oath, as well as a larger commitment to the principles of the United States Constitution and the post-Enlightenment worldview from which it sprang. Here is where Mel would make some crack about how I take myself too seriously, but she's stuck in 1851 at the moment. Furthermore, I don't know whether the reader will have access to digital electronic devices, or for that matter, any post-medieval technology whatsoever. And so I'm writing this in ink on paper, so that you don't need gadgets to read it. Hell, it could be that by the time we reach France, the whole continent will be nothing but smoking ruins. I'm in a steel box on a big boat. I came here with my friends Felix Dorn and Rebecca East Oda. I talked them into this adventure. Not to say they're not grown-ups or anything. For the record, Rebecca is a grandmother. But I take responsibility for this, and if there are legal proceedings to follow, they should be exonerated, because this whole thing was my call. As general background, just to help the reader calibrate the level of weird that's going on, I believe that the building we all know as the Pentagon was called the Trapezoid when it was first built, circa World War II, and that it remained the Trapezoid all through the Cold War and the decades that followed. It only became the Pentagon a few months ago. But when it did, it wasn't only the building itself that changed, but everyone's memories of it as well. So everyone, including me, thinks it has been the Pentagon from the moment its cornerstone, vertex stone, whatever, was laid, and has memories consistent with that. And it's what you'll read in old documents and see on old maps. I have memories of the trapezoid, but they have the same surreal and suspect vibe about them as things seen in dreams, or hallucinated during LSD trips. It was converted into the Pentagon on Halloween, just about 2 months ago, when a significant chunk of the United States military-industrial complex was taken over by witches in a carefully premeditated coup d'état. They remain in power. Well, one does. If you, the reader of this document, are a special forces operative who just finished taking me and Felix down in a raid, or a military intelligence analyst at the Pentagon, then you actually work for her. The witch, that is. Sorry to break it to you. The witch's goal is to roll back scientific and technical progress to roughly the late medieval period. I think they are probably okay with a Leonardo da Vinci level of tech, but once we get into Galileo or even Francis Bacon, these witches get the heebie-jeebies and want to put a stop to it. Compare my earlier remarks about the Enlightenment. Okay, so Felix read the above line while I was peeing into an empty water bottle. We are saving it in case we end up having to drink our own urine in a few days, and he has advised me to get on with some more concrete details of what's happening. Thanks, buddy. But I've done some stuff here that from a narrow-minded point of view looks just incredibly batshit illegal, and I need to explain that. In retrospect, we should never have built the ATO. The whole diachronic operations thing was never perfect. Actually, we had some pretty hairy misadventures from day one, but at least it was under some kind of control as long as we just had a few ODECs that were totally locked down in secure facilities, with necessary biocontainment procedures in place, etc. We used them for one thing and one thing only, time travel, according to a clear set of rules and procedures. Our critical mistake was the recent policy shift toward using ATOs, portable ODECs, for PSYOPs in the present day. Note, Melisande Stokes was always iffy about the PSYOPs tack. Not that she had a say in policy, but given the impact this has had on her fate, she at least deserves her opinion to go on the record. On the face of it, the PSYOPs redirection seemed reasonable, or at least no crazier than diachronic operations. But we didn't reckon on Grania and the fact that she would immediately begin using those very techniques to influence Dodo's top leadership. And Grania, in turn, didn't reckon on Magnus, who didn't reckon on the Fuggers, see below. So lots of people are surprised. I won't retell the whole story here because it can be gleaned from documents on Grimnir, especially Julie Lee's entry, but I do want to record, A, what's happened since then, and B, what I'm pretty sure is the behind-the-curtain truth to what's going on. Which I will do first. I'm leaving out an enormous amount here. I'm not showing my work, as my grade school math teacher would complain, because I don't know how much ink is left in this ballpoint. After Magnus finished getting what he wanted out of the Walmart, treasure maps, basically, and made his getaway, there must have been one witch remaining in the ATO, since a witch can't send herself. I see empty cold-cut wrappers and a whole lot of used water bottles, so somebody was hanging out here for a while. After the siege, when Dos Ecops showed up and Major Isobel Sloan went in to check the still-operating ATO, the witch clearly used some kind of mind-influencing technique on Sloan. The tractor-trailer containing said witch was then shanghaied to Conley Terminal, given a false identity, and sent off to France. Major Sloan was maintained in an altered mental state for a full week while that happened. Eventually, she turned up unharmed in Julie's hotel lobby, and I'm guessing the truck driver has turned up somewhere with a similar story. But, after hashing this out ad nauseam, I need to change/add one detail. The warehouse and all that's happened since is clearly a Fugger operation, which means it must have been a, new to us, Fugger Witch, not Magnus's witch, who was controlling Major Sloane. This in turn means that Magnus's witch got jumped by some other Fugger witch who manifested in the Atto at some point post-Walmart siege and homed Magnus's witch back to Viking-era Norway or wherever, with or without her consent. No idea why the Fuggers stole the Atto from Dodo, or why they are getting it not just out of the country, but specifically to France, which happens to have old secret laws governing the use of magic for diachronic operations. If this all seems even beyond the scope of the Fuggers, remember, Dodo's own Dr. Cornelius Rudge is a Fugger agent. Hi, Dr. Rudge, meaning the Fuggers know whatever Dodo knows, and always have. Also, they are obviously waiting to collect Atto number 1 in Le Havre. So we decided to beat them to it, so that we have a way to get Mel home. Felix and I packed duffel bags with all the gear we could carry and found a chopper pilot who was willing to fly us and Rebecca out to the Alexandre Dumas. We circled the ship a couple of times and identified the Atto. Even though it has a new paint job, it has some identifying characteristics, such as the side door, that make it stand out clearly if you know what to look for. We hailed the ship on VHF. I gave the captain the same story we'd been telling the helicopter pilot, which was that this was an enforcement operation related to a sensitive national security situation, and that it would be best if he just clammed up and didn't make a fuss until I could come and talk to him. And then I requested permission to come aboard, which is the polite thing to do. We landed on the top of the container stack and set a rope, which I used to let myself down to the door. I cut off the padlock with a battery-powered grinder and got it open. We let down a rope ladder and helped Rebecca and the chopper pilot get down and inside. I went back up onto the top of the container stack and walked forward to the ship's superstructure, which projects up above the level of the containers. The captain was waiting for me. I was in full quasi-military tactical gear, and I guess I looked convincing. The captain is Spanish. The crew is Filipino. And, at the end of the day, none of them wants any trouble. They just want to drive this thing to Le Havre and cash their paychecks. I explained to the captain that there was a situation in the red container that he needed to see with his own eyes. It took a little social engineering, which Mel always says I'm not very good at, but after a few minutes he sort of rolled his eyes and agreed to come back and have a look. So now it's me and Rebecca and the chopper pilot and the ship's captain all together in the red container, and I can tell that the Atto system has been turned on. The first few times I experienced the inside of a running O-deck, I came out of it deeply confused, like a kid who'd been roofied at a frat party, but over the years I've become accustomed to it. I can maintain some level of conscious awareness and come out of it a little spacey, but basically intact. The same was not true of the ship's captain and the chopper pilot, who just became listless and generally out of it as soon as I shut the Atto door. Felix, for his part, was smart enough to just hang out on top of the stack until this part of it was over. Witches have no problem in O-decks / Attos, and Rebecca had been practicing enough with Erzabet so that she could give the captain and the chopper pilot a mild talking to, there in the Atto. Outwardly, it just looked like a school librarian lecturing a couple of schoolboys who brought their books back a day overdue. But I could feel the glamour all over the place, as she made sure their memories of all this would be seriously muddled. Go, Rebecca. Then we opened the door and shut off the Atto. The captain went back to his business without a word. The pilot climbed into his chopper and took off, headed back to Boston, taking Rebecca back with him. Not that she isn't game for an adventure at this point, but she's exhausted after her first successful PsyOps mission, and Frank will probably forget to eat if she's not around. As for the ship's crew, all they know is that they saw some weird stuff happen, but it's not in their interest to talk. Felix and I went back into the Atto, removed all of our ropes and carabiners from the outside, and locked the door behind us. Too long didn't read. Magnus hijacked the Atto, the Fuggers hijacked it from Magnus, and now we have hijacked it from the Fuggers. As long as Felix and I keep it powered down, people can't be sent to it. Now we wait.
Entry from personal journal of Carpati Erzsébet.
Budapest, train station, 28 July 1851. Dear diary, today has been the most horrifying of my young life, although I fear it is only the beginning of many days and weeks and decades of woe. This morning, Mother suddenly emerged from her room, descended the stairs, and called me into the great room with a fierce determination on her face, but otherwise so wan as to look waxen, and so haggard as to be almost unrecognizable. Erzsébet, she said, and seemed about to say more. So I stood there, in a wholly receptive state, awaiting her words. But she did not continue to speak to me directly. Rather, she uttered ugly incantations I had never heard before, and a terrible feeling came over my body, as if I were bound with hot iron while being frozen on the inside. I screamed in alarm and pain, but the sensation only grew more intense. It seemed to last for a very, very long time, hours. And then suddenly it stopped, and I found myself lying prone across the ottoman. My skin felt unnaturally tight on me, and I felt somehow heavier. Mother was lying prostrate near me in the doorway, as pale as death. "I've done it," she said grimly. "Better bad magic than no magic at all. Now you will be here for Melisande Stokes." "I will undo it," I said between clenched teeth, fighting off panic. "I do not think so," she said. She turned away from me and tried to raise herself up, but lacked the strength. "Give me an hour to regain my spirit, and I'll undo the spell," I insisted. "And then I will leave here, and you shall never see my face again. In an hour, there will be no more magic anywhere upon this earth," said Mother hoarsely, sinking back onto the carpet and covering her pale face with one pale hand. "The solar eclipse has already begun. Somewhere in Prussia, this Mr. Berkowski has set up his photography equipment. In mere minutes it will all be over. I have no words, dear diary, to express the feeling that came over me. I have refuted any connection to my parents. Immediately I packed a small suitcase and left the house with no idea of where to go. Then I went to the train station and bought a ticket to Praha to stay with my paternal cousin Dagmar, as I know a little bit of Czech. Now, even if I wish to help Miss Melisande Stokes to return to her time, I would be unable to. She is in part to blame for my predicament. For if she had not come, I would not have heard her remedy, and then neither would Mother, and now I would be like Mother or any other witch. A normal, mortal woman. Such simplicity is to be denied me. It is a very bitter fate. In the absence of any other remedy, I suppose I must rely, as my foremothers have in the worst of their years, upon the mercy of the Fuggers.
Exchange of posts on Ops Grimnir Channel. Day 1970, 20 December, Year 5. Response from Tristan Lyons, 5:30.
Anyone there? This is a burner phone I picked up in Boston. You're just going to have to take my word for it that it's me. Seeing one bar, apparently a cell tower in Penzance.
Response from Mortimer Shore, 5:31.
Pirates of Penzance reading you. Welcome to the English Channel, bro.
From Tristan Lyons, 5:33.
They call it La Manche where we're going, but thanks. Everything fine here in the Atto. I think I read the entire works of Dickens and did 80,000 push-ups.
From Mortimer Shore, 5:35.
Heh, I think I drank 80,000 pints in the local.
From Tristan Lyons, 5:37.
What is sit-rep? Got numbers for me?
From Mortimer Shore, 5:40.
All good. By the way, I'm going to lose you in a short while, but later in the morning you will come in range of the island of Jersey, which is where we registered our shipping company. Esme is hanging out there, and Julie's en route Le Havre. Rebecca's in London en route Gatwick, last I heard. Frank and Ersebet are at the house back home. Ersebet's in charge of feeding the cats, LOL.
From Tristan Lyons, 5:45.
Hang on, we have a shipping company?
From Mortimer Shore, 5:47.
Grin, we do now. It was the easiest way to manage the numbers. Turns out that you can't just paint any old number on the back of a shipping container and have it work. There's an owner code and a check digit and some other details, all covered by an ISO spec that I had to get my head around.
From Tristan Lyons, 5:51.
Figured. That's why I asked Rebecca to put you on it.
From Mortimer Shore, 5:55.
So, before you get out of range, here's the number. EHTU 314-1597.
From Tristan Lyons, 5:57.
You used pi? Really?
From Mortimer Shore, 5:58.
Just an accident, smiley face. The 7 is the check digit. If that's not right, the computers in Le Havre will reject it. EHTU is East House Trust, all part of the shipping company thing. Had to do it so it wouldn't cause trouble going through customs in Le Havre.
From Tristan Lyons, 0600.
So if I paint this on the back of the Atto, everything is going to just happen automagically?
From Mortimer Shore, 602.
According to our modern standards of magic, yeah, smiley face. See you in Le Havre.
Post by Rebecca East Oda on Ops Grimnir Channel. 3 hours later, 9:21. From Rebecca East Oda.
Note. Spotty internet, so have written this in real-time commentary, but will now upload all at once. Have reached Portsmouth, which none of us was expecting. In the guise of dotty but vigorous spinster tourist, which isn't too far off in some sense, enjoyed a gusty walk from the railway station to the harbour, where I am now comfortably ensconced at a table in a waterfront pub. We'll explain what I'm doing here. Tristan, I expect you'll be back in cyberspace by the time I upload this, and so you might be wondering what I'm doing on this side of the Atlantic at all. Briefly, the answer is that I came over to London because we had to manage a number of legal and financial transactions related to setting up the new shipping company under the umbrella of the East House Trust. Frank and I are co-trustees, and so a lot of documents needed to be signed. Our scanner was on the blink, and apparently fax machines are no longer au courant. It was simpler for me to just be in this country. So I got on a plane. Frank could not join me because he is still working on the O-deck in our basement. Some parts unexpectedly came in. I was planning to fly home today. I'd have liked that. but we've received some new information about Atto Number 2, and I've changed my plans accordingly. This is a long story, but via Hira Lajani, we received a leak from Dodo 2 days ago, suggesting that hasty arrangements were being made, presumably by Grania, even if Blevins or Frink signed off on them, to get Atto Number 2 moved into a cargo plane, a 747F capable of swallowing a whole shipping container. It turns out that there are persons called plane spotters who have nothing better to do with their time than to keep track of the comings and goings of airplanes. They are all on the Internet, naturally. Thanks to them, Mortimer was able to identify a 747F that made a flight yesterday from Hanscom to Gatwick. I took the train from London to Gatwick and arrived in time to watch from the roof of a nearby hotel as Atto Number 2 was unloaded in plain view and placed on a tractor trailer. I recognized it as an Atto from the side door, which makes it different from other shipping containers. We don't know why Dodo wants an Atto over here, but here it is. Hailed a taxi and asked the driver to attempt to follow the rig. It left the airport southbound, as if headed for Brighton, but we lost track of it. Had the driver deposit me in Brighton and paid him a frightful amount of money, but there was little to see there. It's a resort town, with not much in the way of port facilities. On a hunch, I took the train here to Portsmouth today. By hunch, I mean common sense. There was a brochure about Portsmouth in the Brighton train station, complete with detailed map of its large port, with freight and passenger connections across the channel, including a direct connection to Le Havre. Maybe just a coincidence that Dodo wants their Atto directly across the channel from where the Fugger's Atto is bound, but maybe not. My perch here in this pub gives me a direct view through a chain-link fence topped with copious snarls of razor wire into a huge parking lot adjoining the ferry terminal. Several score tractor-trailer rigs and shipping containers are scattered about the place. One of them is Atto Number 2. It has been dismounted from its trailer and is quietly sitting in a corner of the parking lot. I'm keeping my eye on it.
Update, 40 minutes later.
I am still in the pub. Management have apparently decided I am a harmless train spotter type, which I suppose I am. Here is where my story stops being about an old lady spy and adopts witchy overtones. A few minutes ago, I began to pick up a strong sense of glamour from the Atto. I can both feel it and see it. Elizabeth gets credit for being a good teacher. Clearly the thing has been turned on, meaning there is a witch in there. Grania herself? Possible. But maybe she would want to stay near Blevins to pull his strings. A white van has pulled up to the side of the Atto, just next to its door. From it, men are unloading some kind of cargo and tossing it in through the Atto's side door. I gather it doesn't weigh much, perhaps clothing, stuffed into garbage bags. I presume these people are from Dodo Grania, since Dodo Grania caused this new Atto to be here. Perhaps it is another coincidence, but the passenger ferry to Le Havre departs in 1 hour.
Update, 20 minutes later.
Oh dear. Hang on a moment. Magnus just showed up in an Uber. How very confusing. I thought he and Grania were utterly at odds with each other, re-Walmart shenanigans. Supposition. In light of the Fuggers stealing Atto Number 1, they, Grania and Magnus, realized they would have to make common cause to retrieve it. Still, I wonder what each of them intends to do with it once they have it back. Are they going to share it? Neither of them plays nice in the sandbox with others.
Update, a few minutes later, 10:31.
Strong glamour from the Atto. And men are coming out of it now, one by one, every few minutes, dressed in civilian clothing. But they are Vikings. I think it's the same crew that sacked the Walmart.
Update, 15 minutes later.
White Van just took Magnus and 8 of his Vikings over to the passenger terminal.
They are getting on the ferry to Le Havre.
I'm going to get on the ferry, too, and try not to let Magnus see me. Going to click send on this now. Hopefully I will be able to update you all soon. If I do not, assume it is because the Walmart Vikings have gotten to me. In which case, somebody please remind Frank to water the garden. If you had told me 5 years ago, when Mel and Tristan first knocked on our door, that I would find myself writing that sentence, I'd have laughed you down the street.
Scribbled addendum in pencil at the bottom of Melisande Stokes' Diachronicle in her handwriting.
After requesting a safety deposit box here at the private offices of the Fugger Bank on Threadneedle Street, and giving the agent my name, I was informed I already owned a box. Amazed, I asked it to be brought to me, and saw that it contained a sealed envelope, addressed to me, in Mortimer's gangly penmanship, albeit somewhat ink-blotted. I have memorized its contents, and will leave it here in the box, attached to my diachronicle, for thoroughness. I depart the bank in far higher spirits than I arrived.
Handwritten note on Fugger Bank stationery.
Came back to 1848 to leave this for you to read in 1851. Trippy, huh? We're trying to home you. If you're reading this before July 28th, 1851, cross the channel ASAP to Cullinay, a.k.a. Norman Language Campsite, near Le Havre, inland, on River Diva, if you don't remember. The B&B in our era is chez en voiture. And the family women were openly witchy, descendants of Tira and Imblen. Talk about clan loyalty, woot, until magic stopped. So if you ask for the witch's house, the locals may know where to send you. Fingers crossed, witch of 1851 is cooperative. Have her send you to her own backyard in our time, where, if you get this, there will be an Atto waiting to receive you. Keep your head down and stay low when you arrive. Gotta go. Riding this wearing nothing but Mr. Fugger's greatcoat, and he's really not amused, LOL. Mortimer.
Exchange of posts on Ops Grimnir Channel. 1.5 hours later. Post from Esme Overkleeft. 1217.
You there?
Response from Tristan Lyons. 1219.
Yeah, just got bars.
From Esme Overkleeft, 1220.
Welcome back to the world. I'm on Jersey.
From Tristan Lyons, 1223.
Glad there's a world to get back to. Didn't know what I'd find on the other end of the ocean.
From Esme Overkleeft, 1227.
It's been a little hairy while you were gone. Lots to report. But no major shears, as far as we can tell, in spite of Magnus's best efforts.
From Tristan Lyons, 1228.
Yeah, I'm reading the message from Rebecca. Wow.
From Esme Overkleeft, 1236.
The ferry with Magnus and the other Vikings, and Rebecca, is going to reach Lav shortly before you. You might even be able to see it out the Atto door as you're approaching Le Havre. Taking into account the time zone change, your ETA is around 5:30, a little after sunset. Then unloading should happen as per usual.
From Tristan Lyons, 1240.
Let's talk a little more about per usual. Port operations isn't my strong suit.
From Esme Overkleeft, 1245.
Actual unloading of the ship probably won't start until tomorrow morning. Your container will come off almost immediately because of where it is. The crane will set it down on the wharf. That's when you disable the radio tracking device.
A straddle carrier will pick it up and take it to a temporary storage location farther from the ship. There'll be some customs formalities. We'll take care of that, but if you have any contraband, you should throw it overboard now. A forklift puts on a tractor trailer. The driver of the tractor trailer works for us. He'll drive it away and take it where we told him to.
From Tristan Lyons, 1248.
And where is that? I've been a little out of the loop.
From Esme Overclift, 1250.
Nice little town in Normandy. I think you have been there. Many times, as it were. Smiley face.
From Tristan Lyons, 1253.
Smiley face. What are the fuggers going to think when their atto makes a wrong turn?
From Esme Overclift, 1256.
We don't know their plans, of course, but presumably they were going to take it somewhere safe. And Magnus and his crew mean to intercept it along the way, although we're not sure about the Magnus-Grania relationship at the moment. Neither Magnus nor the Fuggers know about us, hopefully. So when we get it to the farmhouse, we'll have at least a few minutes' breathing room to turn it on and open a window for Mel to come home.
From Tristan Lyons, 1305.
Okay, here's where this time travel shit gets really mind-bending. The Fuggers and Magnus might not know about us today, but they'll sure as hell know about us tomorrow when they notice that their atto has gone missing. And they have at least one atto of their own, dockside in Portsmouth. So what's to prevent them from, I don't know?
From Esme Overclift, 1315.
Don't torture yourself. The most they can do is send a naked Viking into our atto when we turn it on to receive mail. She already has instructions to hit the deck and stay safe as soon as she arrives.
From Tristan Lyons, 1320.
Have reread your last transmission several times and don't understand. How is hitting the deck going to keep her safe from a naked Viking?
From Esme Overclift, 1322.
That's your job.
From Tristan Lyons, 1324.
Huh?
From Esme Overclift, 1326.
Keeping her safe. Got any weapons in there?
From Tristan Lyons, 1328.
Toss them overboard, as you just instructed.
From Esme Overclift, 1330.
How's your hand-to-hand combat skills?
From Tristan Lyons, 1332.
A little rusty, frankly. Fortunately, I have Felix to practice on. Or vice versa.
Diachronicle. Although there is no longer need of it, I suppose out of habit I shall write this in a tone akin to the Diachronicle. That is to say, in accordance with the literary inflections of my most recent and enforced detap. I fell through fragrant darkness and fell tumbling hard to ground on a painfully cold metallic floor that shook and rumbled as if it were a truck being pulled down a country road somewhere, which meant, the atto! I had arrived! I was safe! No, I wasn't! There were three figures grappling violently above me in the eerie ambergreen glow of the atto. Their efforts caused the rumbling. Two were clothed, and they were fighting with a third who was naked, and who was winning.
Stokes, turn it off! Turn it off!
Tristan's voice was familiar, even though sounding a little strangled. As my eyes focused, I saw that he was in a headlock, his neck crooked in one of the naked man's massive arms. With his free hand, the man was swatting away Felix Dorn with an almost casual air. The stranger had tangled blonde hair tumbling down over his shoulders and a reddish beard. He was immense. Being sent is no picnic in the best of circumstances, and being in a working ODEC is always disorienting. I forcefully tamped down the part of me that wanted to celebrate my return to the modern world, trying to focus on the fact that my friends were losing a fight to a man-mountain, and trying to remember how the atto was laid out. I'd never had much to do with the Attos, as they were for PsyOps, and I had always remained focused on diachronic work. Still keeping Tristan's neck in the crook of his arm, the Viking, I assumed he was a Viking, came toward me at a ponderous gait, kicking empty water bottles out of the way as he planted his feet. Tristan was flailing out, trying to grab anything that would serve as an anchor. Felix fell to his knees, staggered by an elbow to the face. The Viking's gaze was fixed on something behind me. I turned and saw the control panel at the forward end of the Atto. I scrambled on hands and knees in that direction, hurled myself toward the panel, and mashed the big red button that served as the emergency off switch. My own momentum then sent me sprawling back to the icy cold floor, my head clearing now that the system was shut down. I drew myself up into a fetal position, spun around, and watched the progress of the fight. Felix's face was gushing blood, probably from a broken nose. He was getting unsteadily back to his feet, and seemed to have his eye on a fire extinguisher, bracketed to the wall at the other end of the Atto. Tristan had managed to reach up and get one hand on the Viking's face, and was now groping around trying to insert a finger in an eye or mouth, but the Viking kept jerking his head away. Tristan finally got purchase on a handful of Viking hair, but it was a feeble grip compared to what the other had on him. I was struck by the Viking's calm patience. This was not a berserker. Indeed, he seemed more like a parent controlling a three-year-old throwing a temper tantrum. The door of the Atto was flung open from without, and slanting sunlight flooded in. Backlit and framed in the entrance was a female form. The Atto light showed her to be a middle-aged woman, wearing a simple house dress with a heavy cardigan over it. She was brandishing a long double-barreled shotgun. Her breath came out like clouds. I smelled apples baking. There was a long moment while we all considered matters. The woman with the shotgun was clearly as surprised by the situation inside the trailer as we were by her sudden appearance. Certainly, she had a lot to take in. Felix stopped moving for the fire extinguisher and held up his bloody hands. Tristan couldn't see what was happening. I watched the woman between the tree trunk legs of the Viking, whose manhood hung down, somewhat obscuring my view. I do believe this organ contracted a smidge when the woman trained the shotgun at him. In fairness, the cold winter air coming in the open door may have accounted for some of that. Certainly the gun got his attention. This wasn't the first time he'd seen a modern firearm. This confused me, for I knew all the Dodo Anachrons by sight, and he was not one of them. The sunlight glanced off his shoulder, highlighting a red scar, fresh and angry-looking, cutting horizontally across one of his cannonball deltoids. The woman demanded,
"Relâchez-le immédiatement!"
Then getting no reaction, she tried in English,
"Leave him go!"
Tristan, hearing her voice, he couldn't see the door, said in a strangulated voice in Norman,
"She has a bang stick."
This was the moment I realized the man probably was a Viking. So I tried Old Norse, a recent, somewhat half-baked addition to my linguistic arsenal. "Whoever you are, that thing will kill you." The Viking released Tristan so abruptly that Tristan fell to the floor. The Viking turned around to face me, then reached up and patted the scar on his shoulder.
"I know it," he returned in Norse. "A coward hit me with one of those accursed weapons in the Walmart."
"Walmart?" I repeated, flummoxed. "What were you doing in a Walmart?" Tristan made a brief sound that might have been coughing, or it might have been laughter.
"Welcome back, Stokes," he said. "You have a lot to get caught up on."
The Atto had been plonked down in the yard next to the same Normandy farmhouse whence I'd been homed in 1851. Very little about the property had changed. There were now telephone wires connected from the road, a satellite dish, a sign reading, "Chez Envoûteur," a bed and breakfast. The woman had run inside to fetch ice for Felix's nose, and white terry bathrobes for me and the Viking, who called himself Thord. The woman, Tristan said, was Anne-Marie. I waited for my bathrobe to arrive while burying my face against Tristan's chest. I never wanted to let go of him, and his arms gripped me tight. Having just been steeped in Victoriana for the past several weeks, I noted that his delight in seeing me once again. Important detail, seeing me entirely unclothed for the first time ever, was reflected in every inch of his healthy and vigorous frame, not excluding the matrimonial organs bestowed upon him by the Creator for the propagation of the race. I put my arms around the small of his back and pulled him into me, just to give him a hint that I had noticed. Pressing my head into his shoulder, he muttered,
"Damn, I'm glad to see you."
"Yes," I said, then pulled away and looked right at him, eye to eye, nose to nose. "I can tell." He reddened a little, then a lot. Then he started laughing and pulled me back against him. We had been avoiding this for 5 years. Time to sort it out. But not immediately. This was France, so first we all had to go inside for coffee, Felix trying to avoid water from leaking onto his jeans as he iced his swelling face. Anne-Marie offered me a woolen dress, which I accepted gratefully. She was nervous about Thord, until Tristan took her aside and explained to her that our Viking friend would be docile now. Most of the farmhouse's ground floor was one great room, kitchen at one end, dining space at the other, the whole of it spanned with a huge plank table that looked like it was 1,000 years old. We sat at one end of this, as Anne-Marie prepped food and drink just beyond the other end. Over croissant tartine, which of course Tristan practically inhaled without tasting, Tristan and Felix caught me up on all the dazzling adventures and misadventures I had missed while I was in San Francisco and London, the chief topics of conversation being the Walmart raid, the Yatto heist shenanigans, and word from Frank that a shipment of high-temperature superconductors had just appeared on the doorstep of the East House. Given that the Fuggers owned the company, this put us in their debt. To bring me up to the minute, there was this further summation. Frank was busy wiring up the superconductors in his cellar to create an ODEC. Julie had rented a hotel suite in Le Havre and was staying there to ensure a base of operations near the port. Rebecca and Mortimer were even now joining her there from their sundry deployments, and Esme was expected to arrive in Le Havre at any moment from Jersey. Thord, amazed by the first-time effects of caffeine, was pacing agitatedly around the farmhouse. By around, I mean circumambulating it barefoot despite the winter chill. Anne-Marie had fairly decent English, and as she moved from our end of the room to hers, she seemed so unfazed by what she was overhearing that I assumed, correctly, Tristan had already told her more than the average abettor would know. "So, if I've got this all straight," I said, "now that you've stolen the Atto from the Fuggers, who stole it from Magnus, who stole it from Dodo, the Fuggers are wondering what became of what they thought would be their Atto." Tristan nodded. "From their point of view, it vanished from the container port in Le Havre. They had a tractor trailer ready and everything. They were expecting to tow it away from there and take it to who knows where." He waved his hand vaguely toward the interior of France. "Someplace safe, anyway. We still don't know who their witch is." "It's rather unsportsmanlike of us to deprive them of an ODEC on the heels of their making it possible for us to build our own."
"Sportsmanship is for sportsmen," muttered Felix,
a bit nasally with the ice pack pressed to his face.
"Anyhow, it was all happening at the same time an ocean apart, and we're telling you to come here, so we had to be here,"
Tristan added. "What do you mean, telling me? You've already told me." Then I realized something didn't make sense. "Wait, how did you send Mortimer back to tell me to come here?"
"We haven't yet," said Tristan. "Julie's gonna send him when they get here."
Seeing the look on my face, he added,
"I know, it's pretty freaky. Don't think about it too much."
"I can't even..." I shook my head. "Never mind. So who's Thord and what's his involvement in all this?"
"Yes," said Anne-Marie suddenly from the kitchen area. "Who is Thord?"
"He's obviously one of the Vikings Magnus recruited," said Felix, "but no idea why he's here now." "We could just ask him. I don't think he's used to coffee,"
Tristan joked. Tristan went outside to collect Thord, still clad in his terry bathrobe, which somehow simply made him seem even more naked. He arrived inside, staring wide-eyed at the exotic domestication of the great room. Anne-Marie, whom he regarded with the greatest respect, even fear, gestured to the end of the bench, which he plopped down onto wordlessly and quickly, like a chastised child. I told him my name and asked if we might interview him, explaining that Tristan and I both had limited abilities to speak his language, which had linguistic ties to what Tristan had learned in these very fields when they were still woods, 1,000 years ago. He agreed, and began by confirming Felix's assumption.
When we returned to Svervik after the raid, I was the only one without the scars in my back, Thord said. This was because I had been injured by the bang stick. I said to Magnus, "Fuck you and your plans, Magnus. I did not want to come in the first place, and now look." So, I did not let them carve maps in my back, because I knew that I would then be part of his plan forever.
Anne-Marie had cleared the coffee and pastries, replacing them immediately with beer, and now was setting out plates of charcuterie and a fresh loaf of bread, which Thord began tearing into at an impressive pace. He chewed for a few moments, gazing out the window at the sun on the trees, while I translated for Felix, and Anne-Marie, who was swapping out ice packs for Felix's nose. Thord swiveled his blue-gray eyes back to us, washed the bread down with a swig of beer, and continued,
"Magnus, after that, began to have dreams. They were dreams of his past, of his boyhood in Normandy and his days as a Varangian guard. But in every single one of those dreams, his life was cut short by murder. He consulted a witch, who explained that he was in fact seeing other strands, and that on each and every one of those strands, the young Magnus had, in fact, been assassinated by agents sent back in time by his enemies. Magnus became like ice on a frozen river, when it is being melted from below by the warming water of the coming spring, and becomes thin and brittle, and you can almost see through it."
Having delivered this poetic metaphor, Thord belched, sighed, and speared a slice of ham.
"He understood that he would cease to exist entirely, or be turned into a mere wraith, unless he made an alliance with others skilled in sending and homing. Thus, he had the witch send him forward to the Dodek in Boston. There, of course, he found himself in the power of Grunye, who was most angry with him, but also satisfied, in a way, that Magnus had come crawling back to ask for her help."
After another pause for him to eat, and belch, and me to translate, Thord continued,
"Grania and Magnus made a pact to fight the Fuggers and get this Atto back in their possession."
He waved in the direction of the yard.
"Magnus cannot do magic, but he can fight, and is a good leader. Grania can do magic, but only in an Odek, and she is otherwise helpless and weak in this world of Walmarts and so on. So, they could help each other. Magnus supplies muscle so that Grania can get things done. In exchange, he becomes rich by raiding gold from wherever he chooses to go, back in the old days. So, Magnus came back to Svervik, saying, 'The Fuggers have stolen the Atto from us. Now we are going to steal it back. I need volunteers.'"
Tristan nodded. Grania, through Blevins, of course, made arrangements to fly Atto number 2 over to Portsmouth on a cargo plane. Magnus and a bunch of Vikings manifested in that Atto yesterday. Those must have been his volunteers from Svervik. Thord listened to my translation of this, then nodded.
"He tried to recruit me. I repeated to him that he could go fuck himself. The others went, as you said. They would cross from England to Normandy on a big ship, and then follow the Atto from Le Havre to the Fortress of the Fuggers, wherever it might be, and then slaughter them and get it back. Or perhaps hijack it en route."
He shrugged.
"Like we do."
"But the plan failed," Tristan prompted him, as I quietly translated for Felix.
The plan failed, as you know, because you stole the Ato, and so it did not go onto the wagon that the Fuggers had waiting, but instead departed by some other way. There was a big mess, and what it came down to was that Magnus begged me to solve his problem for him. When the Ato is turned on, which it must be so that they can save the woman Melisande, then you, Thord, can be sent there at the same moment. They will try to turn it off as soon as they have Melisande back. You must prevent them from hitting the red button. Then we can send more fighters and witches and fill the whole Ato with our people in a short period of time. And then it will be ours. It's just a bit of wrestling after all, and you're good at that.
I saw a little grimace on Tristan's face and a shake of the head, which I took to mean, actually, you're a crap wrestler. You're just overwhelmingly strong.
This plan almost worked, as you saw, Thord continued. But when I saw Anne-Marie with the bang stick pointed at me, I thought to myself, fuck this. I have a wife and children in Iceland. I don't need to pry any more bang stick rocks out of my body, or even perhaps die, just to make everything perfect for Magnus. So, now I will just wait here in this future, until someone can home me.
At this moment, we heard car tires crunching the gravel on the drive outside.
That will be Julie, said Felix. She can home Thord.
She should take you to the hospital first, said Tristan, so you stop bleeding all over Anne-Marie's furniture.
It's just a broken nose, said Felix. I can go to the local vacuum clinic.
Tristan gave him a look, which he did not see because the ice pack obscured it. We're in the middle of nowhere. There's one car, and it has to end up back in Le Havre. Go the hell to Le Havre! Felix was so startled by Tristan's intensity that he removed the ice pack to give Tristan a what-the-fuck-bro look. Tristan immediately stared at the floor. Felix glanced at me, then back at Tristan, back to me. He looked around the room, noting who else was here, just Thord, and figured it out.
Right. I should go to Le Havre, he said. Julie can home Thord tomorrow.
Right. By tomorrow morning, everyone will have congregated in Le Havre, and you can all pile in the car and come back out here together,
said Tristan in a rapid monotone, as if needing to rationalize being alone with me overnight as nothing more than a matter of logistics. Dear reader, it was not a matter of logistics, but you knew that. When you know something is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet, there is a surfeit of tension, both pleasurable and otherwise. So it was for several awkward moments, as Julie came in to greet us, registered my presence, and Thord's, and helped Felix into the car. She was about to ask if I wanted to return with her to Le Havre. Tristan alone needed to stay here, to handle Thord. But then she, like Felix, understood the circumstances, and turned her head away, trying to hide a delighted little smirk. Tristan felt compelled to see the Vikings settled in for the evening, to unburden Anne-Marie of her hostess duties. She vanished into her private rooms, clearly relieved. Other than the room where Thord was to stay overnight, there were two guest bedrooms upstairs. They both had double beds. I chose the cozier room, with one small dormer window. I half-closed the door and turned off the lamp, leaving the small nightlight on. I began to undress, then hesitated, feeling self-conscious, and sat on the bed, waiting. Eventually, I heard Thord's door open and shut, and Tristan's slow footfall on the landing between rooms. Seeing the dim light from my room, he entered and stood in the doorway. Ever the gentleman, even when I did not wish him to be so.
"Just come in," I suggested. "Don't pretend there's anywhere else you're planning to spend the night."
He strode up to the bed and hovered beside me a moment, his arousal nearly in my face, even as his own face, absurdly, attempted to remain subdued.
"We should have some understanding of..."
"After 5 years, if there's anything we still don't understand, fuck it," I said.
and ran my hand up the front of his body, then back down it. He grabbed me, and in one smooth movement picked me up and then tossed me face up onto the bed, settling his weight carefully upon me, nudging my thighs apart with his knees. It felt so good to be trapped beneath him, I almost fainted. Except